That's right. The point that you mentioned about leaving this legacy in their own mother languages about Islam is really important. The program, the teacher is also interested in finding the people who have left different works on different fields of studies regarding the religion of Islam in their own mother tongues, you know, whether it be Japanese, you know, we can say the African ones or any type of language. Okay, Sheikh Matavi, any point missed? We got a final moments of our program for today's discussion.
Actually, I think this is good to appreciate the role of people whom Izotso met in his life.
Okay.
If we look at the works of Izotso, we can say that he received a good influence from the works or from the discussions that he had with the contemporary scholars.
Yes.
Henry Corbin, Said Hossein Nas, there are people whom he met and they had a discussion together. So these meetings, which brings people and scholars from East and the West, and they sit around one table and discuss about Islamic issues with different backgrounds, and we see the fruits.
Yes.
So this is something that we have to appreciate.
Yeah, the dialogue between different people from different religions. That's the real picture that the believing people around the world are looking for. I mean, interfaith and intrafaith dialogue and unity between all the believers with respect. And, you know, this can be found in the scholars. And unfortunately, in the recent years, we could see that the picture that is shown out of the religion of Islam in the Western media is converse and vice versa. It is a barbaric, violent, you know, picture of Islam. But the beautiful side of Islam is these scholarly discussions, you know, among the Muslims and non-Muslims regarding the Holy Quran and the history of Islam. And I think this beautiful aspect is really fascinating. And I invite all non-Muslims to read about Islam and do more research about Islam. January 7th, 1993, Toshihiko Izotso passed away in Japan. May Allah bless his soul. One of the, we can say, people who dedicated his life on research in Islamic mysticism, hikmah, philosophy, and also the text of the Holy Quran. Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahdavi.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya.
You're most welcome.
For your presence in the program, the teacher. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information on this program, visit our website at parstoday.com/ and Call of Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
We once had a teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures. Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from Al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say front of him?
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
WIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the program Viewpoints, and in this series produced by Brother Mahmoud, we are concerned with an analysis on the thoughts and opinions of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on different occasions and different topics. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to your show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Brother Ali Alavian, assalamu alaikum, brother, welcome to your show.
Alaikum assalam, and thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome, brother. So, this is the continuation on the series regarding the important topic, pure Muhammadan Islam or Islam and Nabi Muhammadi, based on the speeches of Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. We enumerated some of the features of this type of Islam we are concerned with, and we said that the main cause and goal of the Islamic revolution of Iran to take place was a kind of revival to this concept, Islam and Nabi Muhammadi, or pure Muhammadan Islam. So, according to the leader of Iran, pure Muhammadan Islam is Sayyid Mohsen, is a kind of Islam that is based on the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Prophet Muhammad. It is not a religion of superstition, deviation, extremism, or some of the attributes that are nowadays, unfortunately, in the media, we can say, used as a label for Islam, radical Islam, Islamism. These are the terms that are used nowadays when you are Googling the term Islam, or we can say Islamophobia also, we can say, which is a fear of Islam. When we say Islam and pure Muhammadan Islam based on the Sunnah and the Holy Quran, what do we mean exactly? So, we have some important pillars in Islam that are accepted by all. These are the causes of the unity, as Rahbar also said. But the main question is, if we are not going to accept Islam through the Holy Quran and the Sunnah, what will be the repercussions, Brother Ali, the consequences for the Muslims?
We need to clarify some points here first. I believe that the leader of the Islamic Ummah, when he talks about the Sunnah and Quran, and he asks us to follow the real Sunnah, he is not actually insisting actually wants others to follow whatever we follow, whatever we understand.
But you mean by we mean Shia, is it?
Yeah, well, okay. I mean as the followers of okay. Ahlul Bayt. But he wants to make us. Actually, this is my understanding. We have a criteria. Our criteria is Quran. Let's base whatever we understand from the Sunnah with Quran. If it goes with Quran, it is okay.
Okay.
You can accept it.
Okay.
Look, whatever Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam say, they are exactly 100% based on the Quran. We cannot find anything saying by Ahlul Bayt or said by Ahlul Bayt, and it is against Quran. So we have, at least we have one common thing.
Okay.
And even Ahlul Bayt to some extent actually is have been accepted, as the brother said, by some other Islamic sects. I don't want to mention any of them specifically. So when we have a criteria, then we can act upon that and go. So in this criteria, we have some bases in Quran. We have some rules in Quran. Based on those rules, we can follow exactly and see what the Prophet understood and what the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam told us. We see that we can reach to an agreement, to a convergence in Islam.
Sorry, Brother Ali, let me disagree you over here.
Tell me.
When you looked at the different magazines and the, we can say, letters and the news produced by ISIS, they said that our understanding is exactly based on the Holy Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sunnah Prophet
Quran, which was interpreted by whom?
Okay, this is the problem. This is my question now. Now, I do want to say, and they were, we can say, attracting so many people by this type of understanding, okay? So, and they were gaining power.
This is what we are going to do now.
This is ideological.
We want to tell them what kind of understanding of Quran is true.
And based on that, different interpreters from the other sources, from the other religions, have criticized Islam that, look, this is the real Islam they are referring to based on the verses of the Holy Quran. I do want to say, mere understanding the Holy Quran or reciting it for long, long times in our prayer and salas does not bring us any kind of recognition of the true meaning of the Quran. This is what, unfortunately, some of the sects inside Islam do, and they say, okay, Holy Quran, a revelation from Allah, so our understanding based on that is absolutely true, so let's recite it, let's recite long surahs from it, and doing this and doing that. A parrot-like imitation out of the sunnah, of the prophetic sunnah. The main question is this: if we are not going to be trapped by these, we can say, deceptions, I mean, the Islam that is the Islam of innovation and superstition, and we want to get back to the main sources and the original Islam. This is, let me repeat my question again. To whom shall we refer in the 21st century?
Look, brother, you said that
all of the people do not have time to go to the Ahlul Bayt books and read them, or read Nahjul Balagha or Sahifa, or do this or do that, brother.
Yeah, right. But you said that the understanding of Quran is not enough. If understanding of Quran is not enough, so what is the good of Quran then?
This is my question.
So I mean,
understanding of the Quran is not enough. I mean, practicing it is something else, isn't it?
Yeah. I want to say, first, in order to practice, you need to understand it first.
Okay.
So understanding on the basis of, for example, some rules and rules of understanding Quran. I mean, you cannot enter a notion and I want to dive into this ocean and capture it and do whatever I can. No, the Quran is an ocean. So for understanding how to dive into it, how to be with it, how to benefit from it.
Okay.
So you need to have some guidelines. Who is giving you the guidelines?
Uh-huh.
So we need to define those people, those who can give us a good understanding, good enlightenment from the Quran.
So everybody from different sects of Muslim will say, "I am the experts of the Quran."
Yes, but the Prophet said, Who is the real interpreter of the Quran? Who is this on the same weight of the Quran? They are the Ahlul Bayt. So this is what he frequently said, and it is accepted by both sects, by different sects in Islam. In Islam world, they have all accepted that the Prophet said that who is the talking Quran? These are the Ahlul Bayt. So they are the ones who can define and interpret Quran in the right way that we are after.
Okay.
So Quran, in this sense, is a good criteria.
Let's have Said Mohsen commenting on what you said.
Someone can argue that these are the hadith that are near Shia. Is Quran enough for us or not? That's the discussion. Okay. That's the new question.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need someone with the Quran or not? Because it is said like the Quran itself is enough. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, verse number, I just mentioned Surah chapter Tawbah, verse number 119.
This is what Khawarij said. I mean, Khawarij said that Quran is enough for us.
So in
verse, Mohsen is also commenting on that. He says Quran is not enough.
It's not. I'm bringing the proof that Quran is not enough on its own.
Okay.
Yeah. And did you get that?
Yeah, yeah.
You said that he's saying Quran is enough for us?
No, I thought that Said under. I mean,
I'm trying to explain why Quran is not enough on its own.
Said is trying to explain why the Holy Quran is not enough.
Sorry for interruption.
Chapter Tawbah, verse number 119. Allah says, "Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu taqullaha wa kunu ma'as sadiqin." I mentioned this verse in the beginning of the program
Yes, that's right.
If you look at the interpretation of tafsir, for example, on one hand, Brother Alavian has mentioned the narrations of the Prophet regarding Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
Does intellect also orders to this or not?
Mm-hmm.
Does intellect or aql also agrees on this or not?
Okay.
One of the greatest scholar amongst the Ahl Sunnah is Fakhr Razi.
That's right.
Who was the great scholar and the philosopher and the theologist, you can say, like amongst the Ahl Sunnah. In his Tafsir Kabir, he mentions under this verse and he argues, what is this? Basically, in this Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is ordering, believers, ya ayyuhalladhina amanu. He's talking to the believers. He says to the believers, ittaqullah. This ittaqullah is obviously following the Quran in order to get the taqwa of Ilahi. Wa kunu ma'a sadiq, and be with the rightful people.
That's right.
Now he argues here, he says that Allah did not mention the believers of the time of the Prophet or after him. He generally talked about all the believers. It means that this verse mentions, covers the believers until the Qiyamah, till the day of judgment. So all the believers who will come till the Qiyamah are under this verse. Number one. Number two, when Allah is talking with the believers and He say be with the truthful ones, so that truthful ones should be someone who is higher in rank than the believers.
Than the believers, very good.
Because obviously believers, they are praying, they are not committing sins. That's why we call them mu'min. Now here we have the difference between Muslim and mu'min. Mu'min is highest rank in the Islam.
Okay.
A person who does not commit any kind of sin and he is following all the rules of the Islam. So he argues that because Allah is talking to the mu'mineen, to the real believers who do not commit sin, the one who can be above them, to whom they, Allah will say, like, you believers need to follow this truthful person.
That's right.
He should be above them. He shouldn't be equal to them. Otherwise,
so there is a hierarchy over
there's
here.
There is a hierarchy.
That's right, very good.
So there, if this hierarchy wasn't there, Allah should say, oh, mu'mineen, follow the mu'mineen.
Uh-huh.
Allah did not say follow the mu'mineen.
Okay.
He said truthful.
That's all right.
On the next step, third step, he argues that this truthful people...
He is Fakhr Razi, you are referring
Fakhr
to.
Fakhr Razi, yes. He said that these truthful people must be infallibles. Now, there's a difference between mu'min and infallible. Infallible who from his birth does not commit any sin.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the prophets are infallible. The A'imma ayat of here refers to the infallibility of the A'imma. So he argues there that these truthful people must be infallible. They are, because they are higher in rank than the mu'mineen.
Okay.
And mu'mineen are the followers of the infallible.
So does Fakhr al-Razi by the term ma'asum mean exactly our infallible imam?
Well,
or
he generally talks about the infallible. They must be infallible. So till the Qiyamah, all the mu'mineen should follow an infallible person. And that is the order of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And if someone does that, he must, in order to get the Quran or taqwa ilahi, we can say like the taqwa of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he needs to follow an infallible. Now, the answer is, and obviously we say we have the answer, who are those infallibles?
Uh-huh.
Even Ahlul Sunnah know that, who are the infallibles. The Ahlul Bayt are the infallibles.
That's right.
And in the Quran we have that. Allah said, like, if you want to give the reward for what the Prophet have done, you need to love the Ahlul Bayt. Mawaddat Ahlul Bayt.
Yes, okay.
So all these things are mentioned there.
Did Fakhr Razi himself follow
Tafsir
the
Kabir.
Did he himself follow the Ahlul Bayt?
Well, that's another
Because we had the same discussion said with
we are arguing
Wahhabi.
That in the Quran when we have
Islam
this verse,
Islam and Nabi Muhammadi through the true sources.
Yeah, I know.
At least I do want to say it is right.
Fakhr Razi in his interpretation, even under the eye of
Tahrir, we are not talking about a specific person.
Let me say one point. Under the ayah, that he says whatever Sayyid says. That actually he proves that
the ma'asum,
the infallibility of the Ahlul Bayt. Actually, when I raised this argument with a follower of another sect in Islam, he turned back to me and said, he was a Shia. Simply, he was also a Shia. What are you saying?
That's because obviously we have this discussion with the brothers as well.
Okay.
When we talk about the Suyuti, Jalaluddin Suyuti, they say, okay, he was the follower of Ahlul Bayt or...
Okay.
When we talk about Fakhr Razi, they say the same thing.
Yes.
What about Abu Hanifa?
Yes.
Imam Abu Hanifa was the follower of Ahlul Bayt. He had this belief that Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam is the bila fasl caliph.
Yes.
Like right after the Prophet, he is the successor of the Prophet.
I do want to say
Imam Hanbal had, Imam Shafi has the same. Imam Shafi has a point.
The best authenticity.
That if the love of Ahlul Bayt is kufr, is disbelieving, then I'm Akfar. I'm the biggest disbeliever in the Islam.
Yeah.
So we have it. At this point, if we are talking to a specific person in a specific, we can say, follower of the specific school of thought.
Even among the caliphs.
He is not authority for us.
Even if it is narrated that Omar said also that if it was not because of Ali more than 100 times I would perish because of the answers and because of everything. I do want to say, if you want to give authenticity to one category of thought, the best I think answer is to extract the answers from and to extract the opinions from the opponents of those groups, and according to what the leader said and what the Shia and Bosa Sunni says, the best interpreters of the Holy Quran have been the Ahlul Bayt themselves, and that's all, and because they have the knowledge, and we know that Among the other sects of Islam who call themselves interpreters or commentators of the Holy Quran, they have all been the students of Imam al-Baghir and Imam al-Sadr, following those lines.
One sentence, if I can add on this. For us, the authenticity of something is what is nearest to the Prophet. In the history, we look for the books.
Okay.
For us today, if someone comes and say Fakhr al-Razi, for example, is a Shia, he's not an authentic thing for us.
Okay.
We need to look in the history. That in history, does the ulama of Ahl Sunnah used to say like Fakhr al-Razi be their imam, Imam al-Kabir, and he had this tafasir, or Jalaluddin Suyuti, or other imams they had. So we need to look at the history, basically.
Yes.
In history, it is proof that he was Mu'tazili, and obviously he was from that. So for us, the argument is, if today our listeners want to go and refer to the real things or the real idea about these scholars, maybe
that's right,
they need to go back to the history,
okay,
and look at the history, that the ones who've been approved by the ulama, their scholars, they are their scholars.
So we have to get back to the original Islam based on studying, and this is what I think the Muslim community and the Muslim youth nowadays lack. Because if we do not have true understanding through studying the Holy Quran, history of Islam and the Sunnah, then the selective, we can say, understanding of the Islam can get into what Sayyid called the British Islam or the American Islam, and not the pure Muhammadan Islam. Thank you very much, Brother Ali Alavian.
Thanks to you,
and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. It was very kind of you. I really benefited from your discussion, and I hope that our dear listeners benefited from this series of the discussions and analysis on the thoughts and some of the most outstanding opinions of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Visit our website, parstoday.com/Iran Call of Islam page. Also our YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. We bid farewell to you. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Sometimes I can't see where I'm supposed to go. Sometimes I speed up when I should take it slow. But through all my hard times, when I lose my way, you're concealing my mistakes, yeah. I know you're always by my side, never turning out your light. When I need you most, your stars will shine. When I'm out there in the darkest place, worn and tired, I can still see you illuminate all my skies. When it feels like I've fallen too far from you, there you are, guiding me through. Whenever I feel down, you can lift me up, turning my life around with your love. No matter how rough it gets, I can wear a smile, 'cause your mercy never dries, yeah.
In the limelight. Saudi Arabia courted the world's top companies to supposedly modernize its economy. Instead, the business environment has grown more hostile and investors are souring under oil-rich kingdom. Foreign investment in Saudi Arabia has remained stubbornly low, and some companies are scaling back their operations or delaying promised expansion plans. We now present you an article written jointly by Stephen Callin and Justin Sheck. The piece is titled U.S. Businesses Sour on Saudi Arabia in Blow to Crown Prince's Growth Plans. According to a report by the Wall Street Journal, American companies are scaling back their operations in Saudi Arabia as business environment has become more hostile in the country. The report said General Electric, Uber Technologies Inc., and other firms were hit by surprise tax assessments, which often total tens of millions of dollars. Adding, construction company Bechtel Corp. sent some contractors home while it attempted to collect an over $1 billion in unpaid bills. Meanwhile, the report noted Bristol-Myers Squibb, Gilead Sciences Ilk, and other drug makers have complained unsuccessfully for years that their intellectual property was being stolen. That has led to foreign investment in Saudi Arabia remaining stubbornly low, with some companies scaling back their operations or delaying promised expansion plans. The situation deals a blow to Saudi Arabia's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, the country's de facto leader, who promised in 2016 to build new industries unrelated to oil amid the country's urgent need to reduce its dependence on oil as the global economy moves away from fossil fuels. The crown prince promised to improve the business climate and create a global hub for innovation, and in October, he pursued his investment agenda at the Future Investment Initiative conference in Riyadh. However, direct foreign investment into the country totaled $5.4 billion in 2020, less than half the level of a decade ago, and well below the $19 billion that the kingdom had targeted. It was going to top $6 billion in 2021, based on data through the third quarter. That excludes the sale of a stake worth $12.4 billion in a Saudi pipeline firm to foreign investors. According to the Wall Street Journal report, one reason why the figure has stayed low is planned projects that fell through. Apple Inc. plans to open a flagship store in central Riyadh several years ago have failed. 555 Group, the developer of the Mall of America, decided not to proceed with its plans to build a multi-billion dollar complex in Saudi Arabia. And movie theater company AMC Entertainment Holdings is relinquishing greater control to its Saudi government partner as it falls behind local rivals. Robert Mogielnicki, resident scholar at the Persian Gulf States Institute think tank in Washington, D.C., said, "Although businesses are attracted to Saudi Arabia's potential, economic practicalities are still being hammered out. For long, it has been difficult to do business in Saudi Arabia, with a sluggish bureaucracy, outmoded legal system, and poor human rights record. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman sought to purportedly change that, pledging big reforms, holding lavish investment conferences in Riyadh, and hobnobbing with Silicon Valley executives. However, his agenda stumbled in 2018 when men working for him killed the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. That scuppered big deals including with Amazon.com, Richard Branson's space tourism venture, and Hollywood super agent Ari Emanuel. Also, the Crown Prince could not change many of the old deterrents to investment, and instead, the country added new ones. Riyadh tried to resolve the issue of a cash crunch by imposing retroactive taxes on dozens of large foreign firms. During the past year and a half, companies including Uber, its regional subsidiary, Careem, and General Electric have faced huge tax liabilities and sometimes extra fines when their appeals were rejected by Saudi courts. The U.S. State Department late last year appealed in vain to the Saudi government for relief. The kingdom further angered foreign firms when it ordered them to move their regional headquarters to Riyadh from Dubai or lose government contracts. They were also forced to employ more Saudis. Additionally, a requirement to improve local content in their products made some goods uncompetitive in comparison with imports. Furthermore, physical safety has become another concern for investors. Although the majority of the people apprehended in Prince Mohammed's crackdowns on criticism or alleged corruption have been Saudi citizens, some have been foreigners. One foreign businessman said he was detained and tortured after he had said publicly that some business laws were unfair in Saudi Arabia. Another, an American citizen, recently authorized the U.S. State Department to reveal relevant information to the media should the person be detained in Saudi Arabia. A second American citizen who sought to expand his Ohio-based nursing home operation was arrested on arrival last year. He was detained in a cramped airport holding cell for 3 days and then deported without explanation. Meanwhile, some companies which have worked in Saudi Arabia for decades have downsized their presence amid disputes over payment from government clients. Contractors on Riyadh's new subway system, including Bechtel, sent some staff home last year over a more than $1 billion payment dispute. Northrop Grumman, which has sold military equipment worth billions of dollars to Saudi Arabia, reduced its activity nearly 2 years ago after the military did not pay for products it provided. Bechtel and Northrop Grumman declined to comment. The Saudi government, meanwhile, has claimed it has reformed public procurement laws to eliminate the problem and cleared the backlog of cases. The situation is often worse for smaller companies and solo entrepreneurs, for whom minor issues can turn into painful ordeals. Suleiman Salahia, a 67-year-old, owned a small business that landscaped Saudi universities and royal palaces. After the government reversed the previous round of widely touted business reforms to favor local competitors, the Palestinian investor petitioned investment officials and then sued them. He said in court he was given less than 2 minutes to plead his case before a judge ruled against him. Barred from working or leaving the country without paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in disputed fees, Suleiman Salahia remains mired in red tape and stranded in Riyadh with his wife and children, who haven't been able to complete their education or start their own careers. After Salahia, already facing the consequences of the court ruling, spoke with a Wall Street Journal reporter in 2018, Saudi police raided his home in the middle of the night, bound his hands and feet and covered his head with a bag. They stuffed him into an SUV and drove him to a small cell, where he remained for 18 days with the air conditioning running full blast and two spotlights keeping him awake. Interrogators asked about his business dealings, the lawsuits, and his meeting with a foreign journalist.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
Ziyara of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Now Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim, alayhi salam, was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam al-Kadhim was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. We find that the biographers of Muslim history have unanimously agreed that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the greatest of the people when it came to obeying and worshipping Allah the Almighty. What is interesting is that these biographers have also written that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam suffered through many tortures and pains. He suffered through many hardships and trials and tribulations. For example, he was put into dark and isolated prisons. In these prisons, some which were incredibly small, no bigger than the size of two or three people put together. But in these dark prisons, it is written in the history books that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was tortured. And despite these tortures and trials and tribulations, those same biographers have written that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the greatest of the people in obeying and worshipping Allah. And these biographers have written that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was so great in his obedience and his worship and his ibadat and his ubudiyah of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, to the extent that he had calluses like that on the knees of a camel upon his head or upon his knees, because of the great extent and the great number and the length of his prostrations, his sujood for Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. These, dear friends, are the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: لو ظهرت الآجال افتضحت الآمال.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, if times of death were revealed, expectations would be debunked.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the beautiful conversations and dialogues of the esteemed and infallible Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam that he talks about this idea of earning our daily bread, of earning and working hard for our sustenance, for our livelihood. It's interesting, but throughout the ages we have found that Islam has been corrupted in the sense where some ideas or some concepts have been forced into Islam and has confused the masses. One such thing which has been pushed into Islam is that idea that Muslims should be poor. Muslims should be paupers. Muslims, therefore, should be beggars. This, of course, is a dangerous and corrupt idea which has been pushed into Islam, where the reality is that Islam promotes, encourages, urges an individual to go earn their livelihood, an individual to go and earn their daily bread, meaning make wealth, make money, be wealthy, have social status and financial status, but give it all, or let's not say all, let's say, but give it on the path of Allah. Yes, sometimes it is necessary to give everything on the path of Allah, as Lady Khadija, Ummul Mu'mineen, the wife of the Holy Prophet, did. She gave her wealth away, all of her wealth, in the path of Islam. And we find that the second divinely appointed Imam, Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, alayhi salam, multiple times he gave away all of his life's savings when it was needed. And so when it is needed, yes, sometimes we must give everything away. But still, earn money, make wealth, don't be poor, don't be a pauper, have financial status. But use this for the sake of Allah. Use this on the path of Allah. Don't become greedy when it is in reality Allah who has given you the sustenance. And the sustenance itself is from Allah. And so Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam was talking with one of his companions, and this companion by the name of Hassan bin Ali bin Hamza comes to him and says that he saw Imam Al-Kadhim working on the land to the extent where the feet of this blessed Imam were soaked with sweat. And so Hassan bin Ali bin Hamza asks Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam, "May I be your ransom? Where are the men who will work with you?" Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam responds, "The one who is better than I and my father worked with their hands." So Hassan bin Ali bin Hamza says, "Who is this individual who was better than you, Imam Al-Kadhim, who was better than your father?" Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam replies, "It was Allah's messenger, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, and the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, and all of my forefathers worked with their hands." And so work is of the behaviors of the prophets, the apostles, and the righteous. And so, dear friends, we must work and earn our daily bread. We must work in order to provide for our families, and we must work in order to earn the sustenance which Allah has destined for us. And in the conclusion, we should spend this on the way of Allah for the sake of Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment I want you to listen to a shorter speech by Shaykh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
So you have the aql daruni, you have the aql which is internal aql, then you have the aql which is outside. And both of them needs to be in harmony for reaching or for that plight towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The emphasis on intellect, the emphasis on knowledge, the emphasis on mannerism, on adab, that's what Ahl Bayt alayhi salam, the Imams, promoted and showed in their akhlaq, in their behavior and approach things. That's why, you know, Imam is known as Kazim, who controlled that, who had hilm, which is one of the qualities of God, who had hilm. And at the same time, the empathy that the Imam had, where he took the suffering of his own self, you know, so that others may not suffer. Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. جئت فينا بالهدى والحب دينا أنت يا بدر المدينة خير خلق الله يا من قد جئت فينا بالهدى
والحب دينا أنت يا بدر المدينة. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
The Limelight.
The United States of America, an upstart militarized country that holds as hostage many of the so-called third world countries created by the retreating European colonialists and has fattened on their economies, is the prime example of a hegemon which, as part of its propaganda war against independent countries, shamelessly resorts to hypocrisy. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading Hypocrisy, the Hallmark of the U.S. Stay tuned for more. It is but natural for countries of the same geographical region, especially those sharing age-old ties of civilization, to get together and explore areas of cooperation beneficial to them in a variety of fields. This ought not to irk outside powers, since a regional grouping does not mean the start of confrontation with other regional blocs in today's concept of the global village. where worldwide cooperation with respect for the independence and sovereignty of all others is the key to the harmony of humanity and peaceful coexistence. Only hegemonic powers whose principal pastime is meddling in the affairs of other countries and imposing will on weak links on the pretext of friendship, that is actually barely disguised hypocrisy, abhor the idea of cooperation among regional states. That is the recent start of implementation of the 25-year Iran-China Accord. The United States of America, an upstart militarized country that holds as hostage many of the so-called third world countries created by the retreating European colonialists and has fattened on their economies, is the prime example of a hegemon, which, as part of its propaganda war against independent countries, shamelessly resorts to hypocrisy. The Islamic Republic of Iran, the prime victim of the extraterritorial evil of the U.S., has over the past four decades safeguarded not only its own independence and sovereignty, but also the rights and aspirations of the people of the region, to the chagrin of Washington, which, in sheer frustration, is presently fueling the flames of war in Yemen, along with its provocation against Russia in Ukraine and against China in Taiwan. That is the reason the American regime is angry at Iran's growing positive influence in the neighborhood and beyond, as well as its strategic cooperation with international heavyweights China and Russia. With Moscow and Beijing rejecting Washington's economic terrorism against Tehran, and with public opinion in the U.S. questioning the White House's unwise policy of prolonging the unwanted presence of Yankee troops in Syria and Iraq at the risk of their return home in body bags, President Joe Biden's men have stepped up their hypocrisy. For instance, the Biden regime remains silent on Saudi Arabia's recent bombing campaign in Yemen, and even Riyadh's pointless accusations against Iran. The U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price made a laughing stock of himself by claiming the flow of Iranian weapons to Yemen is enabling the Houthi offensive against Marib. He or his superiors didn't even bother to think that if the alleged 1,400 AK-47 assault rifles and 226,600 rounds of ammunition from a vessel claimed to be from Iran, of course without evidence, prolonged the war and civilian suffering, what does $650 million worth of sophisticated American weapons, which Biden recently sold to Saudi Arabia, do? Do they bring peace? Do they alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni people? Do they save bloodshed? Moreover, during Christmas, when the Americans are supposed to reflect on the teachings of the messenger of peace, Jesus, and oppose all crimes against humanity, the United States regime condemned a cross-border attack by Yemen's defenders on the Jizan province of invader Saudi Arabia, but said nothing about Riyadh's bombing of the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. These same lies are evident in U.S. support for the illegal Zionist entity's stockpile of nuclear weapons, and the wild charges against Iran, the only world country which has religiously forbidden manufacture of all weapons of mass destruction. Height of hypocrisy indeed, by a morally bankrupt and politically failed hegemon, which is rightly regarded as the great Satan by Iranians and conscientious people all over the world.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is in hot water, facing a growing leadership challenge. Johnson had already run the gauntlet of public anger for his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. Now, Johnson is under growing pressure from members of parliament, some of whom Tory lawmakers, after revelations that he attended a garden party at his Downing Street residence in May 2020 in breach of his government's coronavirus lockdown rules. The scandal even worsened after it was disclosed that a party was also held in Downing Street the night before the funeral of Prince Philip last April, when mixing indoors was banned. The stories about rule-breaking get-togethers had caused deep anger, and to thousands who had lost relatives or friends to COVID-19, intense anguish and pain. The mix was potentially politically lethal for the entire Conservative Party. Johnson himself has shifted from the party's biggest asset, with a Brexit-fueled appeal separate to the Conservative brand, to its biggest liability. Not only had Johnson lost his respect, but also sticking with him risks further contaminating the party brand if the scandals continue. The UK government has launched an internal inquiry into revelations about multiple gatherings by Johnson's staff during COVID lockdowns. Johnson himself has apologized for attending what he called only a work meeting at a time when social mixing was banned. Meanwhile, the opposition, Labour, has seized the opportunity, saying Johnson broke the law, lied, and must resign. The opposition Labour Party, which has surged in the polls since the Partygate revelations began emerging last month, says Johnson is unfit for office. Sir Keir Starmer said the Prime Minister's actions and his inability to take any responsibility for them means he can no longer do his basic duties. A new poll released on Sunday showed that the Labour Party has opened up its biggest lead against the Tories since 2013 amid criticism leveled at Boris Johnson and his party over social gatherings during COVID-19 lockdowns. The poll conducted by Opinium says Johnson's personal approvals fall below the worst figures ever recorded by Theresa May. Just 22% of people approve of the job Johnson is doing as Prime Minister. Also, his party sinks to its worst vote shares since the general election, 10 points behind Labour. Also, around two-thirds of people surveyed believe Johnson and his colleagues have broken the rules and lied about it, and say Johnson should resign. That's why Boris Johnson secured a landslide election victory in 2019. But according to the poll, nearly half of Conservative voters at the 2019 election now say he should have stepped down. The Sunday Times reported that Johnson will look to get on the front foot and save his position by making a series of populist announcements in the coming weeks, including reducing the national health system backlog, tackling the small boat crossings in the Channel, freezing the BBC license fee for 2 years, and introducing a booze ban in Downing Street. But is that enough? The latest poll shows voters across the political spectrum are angry with the revelations, and most of those who supported the Conservatives in the 2019 election are turning against them. add to it a looming cost of living crisis